Today is Tuesday, November 19th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, fears of a violent crackdown as anti-government protests in Hong Kong reach a tipping point. A very big week ahead for testimony in the impeachment hearings of President Donald Trump.
Operated by agents like Rudy Giuliani, Gordon Sondland, and Mick Mulvaney.
Also ahead, Taylor Swift is about to receive a first-of-its-kind award at Billboard's upcoming 2019 Women in Music event. It's all on today's International Edition. Dozens of student protesters in Hong Kong made frantic efforts Monday to escape Polytechnic University, that has been surrounded by riot police as the campus siege entered a second day. Some managed to get out by shimmying down plastic hosing from a bridge, fleeing on waiting motorbikes as police fired projectiles. Many more anti-government protesters remain trapped inside the Hong Kong University.
I can't imagine it is happening in Hong Kong. We are like a civilized city. We are witnessing many uncivilized acts, in my opinion. Like, you're arresting someone without any weapons. Many things that are beyond description. They think the most violent group of people is inside, but in my opinion, they are not really violent. They are just acting in response to the police force.
Big explosions were heard and flames flared up at a distant part of the campus. And in nearby streets, protesters rained down petrol bombs, burned parked cars, and the front of a Standard Chartered bank branch. VOA's Bill Gallo joined us earlier from Hong Kong, where there are concerns that all of this could end up in a very violent crackdown. Bill, these are some of the most intense violence protests we've seen in the 5 months of anti-government demonstrations there. What is the latest on what you've been seeing?
Well, there still is a group of hardcore protesters who remain trapped in the Hong Kong Polytechnic University. We don't know exactly how many are there. There's been sort of a slow trickle out. Every now and then you will have a negotiator go in and bring out a few students. Those students almost certainly will be going to jail, probably on rioting or other charges. What you also have is a situation where others are trying to make a run for it. So on Monday, there was several attempts, some concerted, some individual attempts, to flee the campus. This is an urban campus. There are many ways out, but still it's surrounded by thousands and thousands of riot police who are heavily armed, and they are not letting the students escape. So you had some escaping, rappelling off ropes from bridges and walkways onto waiting motorcycles, which, by the way, I don't know how the motorcycles got where they did. Some of those students were able to actually make it out. You also had a situation where there were people on the outside, protesters, in support of those on the inside, trying to reach the campus, so far unsuccessfully, though.
It looked pretty fiery. Were there explosions or gunfire? What were some of the tactics that were being used to get to the students, or for the students to get out, for that matter?
It indeed has been very fiery of a battle. On the one hand, you have police using tear gas, which, of course, can be flammable, and on the other hand, you have the protesters who are, I would say, their main weapon of resistance is Molotov cocktails, petrol bombs, which they're flinging towards police and setting large fires in order to prevent them from making any advances. And yes, the campus is, for all intents and purposes, probably very much destroyed. Not completely destroyed, but there were large parts of the campus over the past 24 hours or more that have been on fire, and there's no one really to put the fires out as far as fire crews or anything like that. So it is very dangerous. We haven't actually heard any reports of deaths, which is shocking, really, when you think about it, for the level of violence that's taking place.
And is it still status quo, pretty much things continuing just sort of the same?
Yes, we have a steady trickle of students leaving the campus because it's not clear how many weapons they have left. It's not clear how much food they have left. These students took over the campus cafeteria and the canteen. So, you know, I can assume, I guess, that there's quite a bit of food on an entire college campus. However, there had been thousands of students there for days. So presumably the food supplies are running out, and presumably the sanitation situation is not great. But I think you have a lot of people who are now deciding, well, this is not exactly the place I want to stay. But at this point, it doesn't seem that the status quo has changed any in the last 12 hours or so.
Sounds like a war zone, you know, but these protesters are digging in, as are the police and the government.
Yeah, this is very different from the large sort of mass demonstrations that we saw over the last 5 months in Hong Kong. These students are dug in. They're prepared to fight. I was there actually a couple of days before this all began, whenever they had said, this is where we're at. We're barricading ourselves in. They were stockpiling whatever they could to protect themselves. And it was just a whole lot different than people out on the street marching, is all I can say about it.
One thing I don't understand is, if they were trying to get out, why would the police block them? I would think they would want to let them out and have them stop this and arrest them.
I think from the police point of view, they decided at a certain point that what the students had done in attacking police and vandalism, etc., of the campus represented a crime, and they had determined that if the students were there, they were part of an illegal gathering. And as such, I think they are trying to both enforce the law and set an example for future actions, that if you decide to barricade yourself in a campus or another setting like this, that this is what will happen to you, that you cannot just escape. And you know, there be no ramifications. But I think that's a justification from the police perspective. Now, of course, you don't actually know what every student has done here. There may be some trapped, and in fact, you have seen reports of very young people in the campus who may not have known exactly what they were doing, or who may just actually be there to help. We've saw reports of first aid helpers and things being arrested on riot charges. So it's not at all clear that everyone there is involved in some of the more aggressive stuff.
All right, VOA correspondent Bill Gallo in Hong Kong. Stay safe, and thanks for the update. Well, this is expected to be a very busy week and potentially impactful one in testimony on Capitol Hill for the impeachment hearings of President Donald Trump. One issue contradicts Trump's argument that State Department officials were told in May that Ukraine's president was feeling pressured by U.S. officials. He said they were never pressured. AP correspondent Mike Gracia reports.
The central allegation of the impeachment inquiry against President Donald Trump is that Trump, through his allies, demanded that Ukraine launch an investigation of former Vice President Joe Biden and his son Hunter. Trump and his defenders maintain no pressure was exerted on Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky. But two people with knowledge of the matter tell the Associated Press State Department officials at the U.S. Embassy in Kyiv and in Washington were briefed on concerns voiced by Zelensky after a May 7th meeting. That would have been more than 2 months before the July call with Trump, reported by a whistleblower, that led to the impeachment inquiry.
Meanwhile, Democrats are responding skeptically to President Trump's declaration that he'll strongly consider testifying. AP correspondent Rita Foley has that part of the story.
Will President Trump testify in the House impeachment inquiry? President Trump is suggesting he may be willing to testify in writing, even though he says he did nothing wrong. He tweets that he doesn't want to give credibility to the no due process hoax, but he wants to get Congress focused again. On Sunday, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi publicly invited the president to testify, pushing back against his complaints that the process was stacked against him. Top Senate Democrat Chuck Schumer pointed out the White House has blocked witnesses from appearing and said that begs the question, what is he hiding? Rita Foley, Washington.
Well, there are also new reports that congressional Democrats will be examining truthfulness of Trump's testimony in the Russia 2016 election interference probe. Trump initially offered to testify in that investigation, but ultimately only provided written answers after months of negotiations. And those answers drew renewed scrutiny after they appeared to conflict with the testimony of former Trump campaign official last week, Roger Stone. The U.S. House of Representatives, again, is holding its second week of public hearings on the impeachment inquiry, with testimony this week by 9 aides and officials, including the top diplomat to the European Union. The hearings will be today, Tuesday, through Thursday. Here are some of the stories we're following at voanews.com. The International Atomic Energy Agency says Iran's heavy water stock exceeds the authorized limit. Mali's army says 24 soldiers and 17 militants have been killed in an attack on a northern patrol. Spain has ordered the extradition of Venezuela's ex-intelligence chief to the U.S. And President Trump is backing off of banning vaping flavors popular with teens. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. The United States on Monday effectively backed Israel's right to build Jewish settlements on the occupied West Bank by abandoning its four-decade-old position that they were inconsistent with international law. The announcement by Secretary of State Mike Pompeo was a victory for Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, who's struggling to remain in power, and a defeat for the Palestinians.
The Trump administration is reversing the Obama administration's approach towards Israeli settlements. U.S. public statements on settlement activities in the West Bank have been inconsistent over decades.
Israel captured the West Bank in 1967. The announcement reverses a formal legal position taken by the United States under President Jimmy Carter in 1978. Pompeo's announcement drew immediate praise from Netanyahu, condemnation from Palestinian officials, and a warning by U.S. officials to Americans in the region to exercise greater vigilance because those opposing the move may target U.S. government facilities, private interests, and citizens. Joining us to discuss this move, this controversial move, is Rabbi Terry Bookman. He's the author of the new book, Beyond Survival, How Judaism Can Thrive in the 21st Century. Thank you for being with us, sir. So what's your reaction to this reversal in positions?
I think this is part of an ongoing pattern with the Trump administration appealing to his base, which is the right-wing segment of the American Jewish community and the right-wing 50%, if you will, of Israel, which wants to defy the rest of the world and international agreements and laws and continue to declare that all of the ancient land of Israel from the river to the sea really is part of Israel. And I think that it does represent a kind of view that exists in Israel. Again, the country is pretty well divided, as we see, in terms of them not being able to form a government. And that there is a segment of the American Jewish community, mostly ultra-Orthodox Jews, but some secular Jews as well, who support that notion of whatever Israel wants is right. It's a piece of a kind of a theology / political stand which seeks to divide or defy the rest of the world.
Right, because it does not only go against the international consensus on the illegality of these Israeli settlements, but also, according to Amnesty International USA, it goes against the U.S. legal obligation to respect the Geneva Conventions. Why do you think that it would go to that level with it?
You know, when I read the Trump administration consistently appealing to its base, which is 30 to 35% of the American population, which has a kind of a right-wing, towards racist, sometimes misogynist policy around the world. It makes rational sense. I mean, they're voting for the embassy in Jerusalem, they're declaring that the Golan Heights is part of Israel, now the settlement, legal kosher. I mean, this is all that belief system that all of the land belongs to Israel. The problem with it is the same problem that's existed since the Six-Day War, and that is, how does Israel maintain its purported Jewish identity as well as being a democratic state? It cannot do that while subjugating the rights of millions of Palestinians, which it has since 67. I understand in the very aftermath of a surprise victory, they couldn't figure out what to do, but it's more than 50 years later, and this stalemate has existed. And, you know, I think there are many people who have given up on the idea of a two-state solution, that it's just never going to come about, which continues to be the belief of most nations of the world and most of the Jewish community in the States. We believe in a two-state solution, which would provide security, recognized borders, and separation between the Palestinian population and the Israeli population.
Right, because obviously that disputed territory is really a key factor in any two-state solution.
And the more settlements that are created and now recognized as legitimate, the more difficult a realistic second state or a Palestinian state, because what happens with these settlements is it divides the territory into separate cantons that are separated by Israeli-controlled roads, which really makes for an impossible kind of state, which was really what, in a way, started the whole conflict to begin with, is that the United Nations, in its wisdom, divided the Palestinian mandate into segments which were disconnected, which, of course, if everybody got along, could have potentially worked out. But you can imagine that Washington, D.C. is a separate country from Philadelphia, and that there's a road that connects them, but that road is controlled by a separate party. And what kind of country is it? And you really don't get that until you're on the ground in Israel and you really see what these settlements have in fact created. They are, for the people who are in the settlement movement, they really do not believe in a two-state solution. They believe in a one-state that will be a Israeli state, and they have policies from the very far right, which is to remove the Palestinian population, to the other side within that bloc, which hopes they will just either move or settle elsewhere so that the entire land can be controlled by the state of Israel. And it's a fantasy. It's not going to happen. And what happened, the result is that, you know, Israel now controls the life and destiny of millions of people who are stateless. And that is not democratic. That's inherently undemocratic. And it's just been for over 50 years.
Does it matter at this point, a statement by the United States, or is it just sort of a symbolic statement that won't really have any bearing on what the Israelis and the Palestinians do together to try to find some solution to these ongoing difficulties?
Well, it gives credence to Netanyahu and that segment of Israeli society. And Israeli society is pretty evenly divided, as has been demonstrated by the recent election and then the re-election and the inability of Netanyahu to form a government. And now Gantz is a few days away from his mandate to form a government running out. Israeli society is split pretty much down the middle, with half the population wanting to control all of the land forever and Palestinian rights be damned. And the other part, which believes that a fair settlement is both in the interest of the Palestinians and the Israelis, although from what I understand, Gantz was very warm to a decision of the United States government that the settlements are not illegal.
All right. That is Rabbi Terry Bookman, author of Beyond Survival, How Judaism Can Thrive in the 21st Century. Thanks for being with us. The African continent accounts for a whopping 90% of the world's malaria cases, and scientists in Burkina Faso recently deployed a new weapon in the war on malaria. As VOA's Arash Arabasadi reports, their battle faces bioethical blowback.
Scientists at this lab in Burkina Faso have deployed gene warfare against the parasite-carrying mosquitoes that spread malaria.
The conventional tools at our disposal today have reached a ceiling and can't become more efficient than they are right now. We have no choice but to look at complementary methods. That is why we're using genetically modified mosquitoes.
Professor Diabate runs the experiment for Target Malaria, a research consortium backed by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. The group developed an enzyme that sterilizes male mosquitoes.
The action of the enzyme continues after fertilization, which means if the male copulates with a female, the embryo is dead and the female can no longer have offspring.
But gene modification has triggered protests. Protesters question the long-term effects on ecosystems when scientists play God.
The future is very uncertain with these mosquitoes. The future is catastrophic. The future is dark. Imagine these modified mosquitoes unleashed on nature. They may release pathogens or viruses. Entire populations and ecosystems will be decimated.
But outside Burkina Faso's capital, any solution to malaria is welcome.
In the village, we are all grateful for Target Malaria because we think the project will reduce malaria, which is killing our sons and daughters. The project is not just for us. It is for the whole world. We pray for its success.
Target Malaria says the plan is to develop a genetic fighting tool that is durable, affordable, and cost-effective.
African children have been dying of malaria for years. The goal is to release it in the field to reduce the density of these mosquitoes one way or another.
A gene drive is a term for genetic engineering that alters the probability of genes passed to offspring. In November 2018, signatories of a UN Convention on Biodiversity noted uncertainties regarding engineered gene drives. Critics fear future modifications to humans or its use in biological weapons. Arash Arabasadi, VOA News, Washington.
And you're listening to International Edition on VOA.
Need a little straight talk? Want to make sense of the world around you? Ask a question. Hear what others have to say? If so, Voice of America has a variety of talk shows for you. Lifestyle, health, politics, youth, sports. We have it all. Tune into our discussion shows on the radio, TV, or the internet. They examine a wide variety of issues and world events not always covered by other media. VOA.
Hi, I'm Nikki Strong. You love music? How about Blake Shelton and Carrie Underwood? Or Merle Haggard and Loretta Lynn? Experience the best in country music on Country Hits USA. I bring you some country rock, outlaw, a little hillbilly, contemporary, and more, with a dash of entertainment news, too. So join me for Country Hits USA on VOA 1, the voice of America.
VOA's International Edition continues. The end of the year is approaching, and it's often a time for great movies as the weather gets cold and Americans head to cozy up in theaters. Joining us now for two reviews of new movies, Vegas film critic Jeffrey K. Howard. I know you're in Los Angeles working on some Netflix stuff, but you did see the new movie, the true story, Ford versus Ferrari. What's that all about?
Well, it is based on the true events of Henry Ford II going after Ferrari himself in 1966 at the Le Mans race. It's the most prestigious race there is.
And that's it, folks. Ferrari wins the 24 Hours of Le Mans for the fifth consecutive year.
Mr. Ford, Ferrari has a message for you, sir.
What did he say?
He said Ford makes ugly little cars in ugly factories. And he calls you fat, sir.
And Henry Ford II didn't like the insults that Ferrari was throwing at him. Because, you know, back in the mid-60s, you know, Ford meant grocery getter cars and they were safe cars, you know, those kind of things. They weren't considered race cars. They weren't considered stylish or sexy or anything like that. So he, after being insulted, Henry Ford said, here's a blank check. I want to win Le Mans and I'm going to be there when it happens to rub it in Ferrari's face. So this rivalry started and ended in true race car fashion. So he went out and found the best race car driver and the best race car builder. Carroll Shelby, played by Matt Damon, and then also he got the best race car driver of the time, played by Christian Bale, and it was Ken Miles. So the movie is not only about them building the most incredible car with 3 months to go to win this race, but also the dynamic between these two men, you know, between Carroll Shelby and Ken Miles. They were true professionals. They were good friends. Of course, they argued back and forth. Also about all the backdoor dealings going on at the Ford Motor Company, you know, with Josh Lucas playing Henry Ford's little assistant, trying to manipulate everything. Even John Berthold playing Leah Iacocca, telling Henry Ford, look, we've got to do something to capture the new young generation. They all have got money. They want to buy sexy cars. And this is a way to get Ford's name out there by winning the ultimate race. So James Mangold, the director of this film, everything you see in this movie is shot in real time. No computer effects. So when you see these race cars going, when you see these point of view shots, it is just the most exciting thing I've seen all year. And I'm not a race car guy at all. I'm not a car guy at all. And I really think, get ready for this.
Yeah.
This is really probably the best film of 2019. I'm waiting to see what
that. You say that a lot. You always see great movies.
I do. But I'm like, this is definitely in my top five. But I love this film. And the performances by Christian Bale and Matt Damon, and just, it's just a fantastic film. It really is. It moves so quickly. It's so exciting. It's so informative. And it reminded me about a time in American history that we were innovators, that we accepted challenges, and we just pursued perfection. And that's what we just lost now, I think, in this country, you know, in terms of manufacturing of that can-do spirit, you know. And this is a time where it was like, what's it going to happen? You know, it's like going to the moon, you know, when Kennedy said that. Then it's like, well, that's impossible. No, we're going to do it. So this is a small kind of can-do attitude. It is so exciting. Ford versus Ferrari, go see it.
All right. And I guess when it gets closer to the end of December, we'll have to do an end-of-the-year prediction on the best movies of the year.
Absolutely, we'll do it.
All right. Well, in the meantime, if people aren't into the whole Ford versus Ferrari true story kind of thing and they just want something light and sweet, there's always time for a good romantic comedy, and you've got one to talk about, Last Christmas.
Last Christmas with the music of George Michael.
Last
including the title of the film. We have from director Paul Feig, who knows his romantic comedies, everything from Ghostbusters to Bridesmaids. He knows how to really deliver the romantic comedy. And this is about Emilia Clarke, who's living in London, and she's working at a store during Christmas. That's Christmas 24/7. You know, Michelle Yeoh owns this store that's always selling Christmas items. And one day, she sees Henry Golding, you know, from Crazy Rich Asians. He's walking around the store. She's kind of interested in him. He keeps coming by, trying to get her number, trying to get her to go volunteer work with him and do all these things. So he's like the perfect catch. So it's about this romance they have, where she's like a schoolboy too. She doesn't, you know, she's always late for work, and she's just a dreamer. And, you know, so Emilia Clarke is just so charming and just such an oddball. And Henry Golding is that rock, you know. Now, the thing is, it's your standard romantic comedy. And without giving anything away, there is a major twist at the end of this movie. I mean, a twist that I did not see coming. And you ready for this? I cried. And I don't mean just cried like, oh, that was touching. I cried on the way to the car. I cried on the way home. I cried all the way home because of this stupid movie.
Oh, you know? My goodness.
So I really think that people are going to love the twist at the end and just be talking about it for the rest of the year. Also starring Emma Thompson, who also wrote the screenplay. You know, so this is going to be a new standard romantic holiday for the holidays.
And if anybody knows you, they know that looking at you, you would not look like the type that would cry.
That's true. And George Michael's music is throughout the whole movie. Mm. And I just miss George Michael. His music lifts your soul. Mm-hmm. And he's just so good, from Last Christmas to, you know, Faith. I mean, all the songs are in there. Wow. And it's a wonderful experience. It really is.
Sounds great. All right. Well, we always appreciate your perspective, Jeffrey K. Howard. You can find his full video reviews at VegasFilmCritic.com. Thanks so much, Jeff.
My pleasure.
Taylor Swift is about to receive the first ever Woman of the Decade honor at Billboard Awards Women in Music Ceremony, which is coming up in early December at the Hollywood Palladium in Los Angeles, California. Billboard's honoring the singer-songwriter for, as they quote, one of the most accomplished musical artists of all time over the course of the 2010s. She's been a musical phenomenon with a multitude of accolades, including 5 number one albums on the Billboard 200 this decade, 5 number one singles on the Billboard Hot 100 chart, 3 worldwide stadium tours, 2 Billboard Woman of the Year awards, and more. Billboard is also noting that she's being honored for her philanthropic work, including music education, literacy programs, cancer research, disaster relief, and the Time's Up initiative. The 14th annual event will also honor a number of other high-profile female artists, including Alanis Morissette, Brandi Carlile, Nicki Minaj, and many more. You've been listening to International Edition. That does it for our show today, but you can find us anytime at voanews.com. Thank you so much for joining us. And thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Jimmy Cook. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a wonderful day. Must have taken all night. You just need to take several seats and then try to restore the peace and control your urges to scream about all the people you hate. Cause shade never made anybody less gay. So, who are killing it, but we figured you out. We all know now, we all got crowns. You need to calm down. Uh-oh. You need to calm down. You need to calm down. You're being too loud. You're being too loud. And that's like, uh-oh. You need to just stop. Can you stop? Like, can you just
This is VOA.